This is Fresh Air. Malcolm Brown was one of the younger reporters to cover the Vietnam War and about the oldest to cover the Gulf War. In 1961, he became the Associated Press's Saigon bureau chief. He covered the Vietnam War for close to a decade. He shared a Pulitzer Prize with David Halberstam in 1964. He was 60 when he went to the Gulf for the New York Times. He's been a foreign correspondent for most of his career, but now he's a science reporter for the Times. He's written a new memoir called Muddy Boots and Red Socks. The book includes a horrifying photograph Brown took in 1963 that became a familiar image around the world. It was a picture of a Buddhist monk sitting in the lotus position while completely engulfed in flames. This was the first Vietnamese monk to set himself on fire in protest against the authoritarian regime. Brown told me about the day he took that picture.
Well, in brief, it was one of the worst days of my life, that's for sure. I had known sometime in advance that there would be a demonstration, but of course I had no idea that there'd be an immolation. There were, in those days, this was the summer of 1963, there was an upheaval going on in Vietnam, led by the Buddhist monks against the Catholic presidency of Ngo Dinh Diem, but also, just in general, against the government. There was great discontent, popular discontent with the government. What actually happened, the procession led to a downtown street corner in Saigon, one of the busiest corners in that bustling city, and then it stopped suddenly, and among the marchers was an automobile. It was an old Austin, as a matter of fact, and the old monk got out of the Austin, accompanied by two much younger monks carrying a jerry can full of gasoline. And Thich Quang Duc seated himself on a little pallet or pillow in the center of the intersection. The other two monks poured gasoline over him. He lighted himself. And he was not in a trance or anything. His face was agonized. He was clearly going through the horrors of burning to death without any palliative for his pain. And it took him, I suppose, about 10 minutes to die. And I've been asked how I could stand to watch this thing. Well, I had work to do. I think news correspondents in general find a release in work. If you have to concentrate on the exposure setting of a camera or of taking notes or anything of that sort, you tend to overlook the horrors that you may be witnessing. And that was what kind of saved me that day, I suppose.
You did write, though, that you were trying hard not to perceive what you were witnessing.
Yes, that's absolutely right, because If I really had perceived it and thought about it, I suppose I just couldn't have stood it.
Now, did you write the story as well as take the pictures?
Oh, yes, of course. Pictures really do have a great deal more impact than words, and sometimes sometimes misleadingly so. Pictures are not necessarily as realistic as words. It's been argued by some critics. Well, I should say that that it had an immediate impact on the White House. It happened that Henry Cabot Lodge was just getting ready to come out to Saigon as U.S. ambassador at the time that happened. And as he was getting his final briefing by President Kennedy, he noticed that my photograph on Kennedy's desk, and Kennedy made some comment about how we're going to really have to do something about that government in Saigon. But the picture did obviously have a great impact. It was used as a propaganda photograph by Peking for some time. Moscow used it also with captions like, a Buddhist monk burns in protest against U.S. imperialism, all that kind of thing. It became sort of a symbol, many things to many different people. I think to this day, as a matter of fact, it's exhibited in Saigon. I know it is, attached to the car that brought Thich Quang Duc to his suicide. And so it's sort of venerated as part of the iconography of the death of that monk.
I want to ask you about another story that you covered in Vietnam. And this is a story you were very personally involved in. You were shot down in a helicopter in Vietnam. You were knocked unconscious. And then when you got conscious again, you had to write up the story, of course, leaving out the more personal aspects of it. But you write in the book, and I found this very interesting, that it was really difficult for you to kind of convey the impact of the story, and that a lot of writers, you think, in that kind of situation find themselves resorting to clichés.
That's absolutely right. Somehow, whatever skills one have seem to to desert one after a day like that, after one is sort of literally cheated death. Actually, I was shot down three times. The one you're talking about was early in the war in an H-21, a banana-shaped helicopter. If you've been sort of dragged away from your task of writing and confronted death, your whole sort of mental outlook changes just long enough to foul up your writing quite badly for at least 24 hours.
What kind of difference in reporting and writing styles did you find between the older and the younger journalists in Vietnam?
Most of the older ones, by the way, who were not resident in Vietnam in those years, they, for the most part, they came from their bases either in Hong Kong or Tokyo, or in some cases from the United States. But they, for the most part, had been schooled in World War II and Korea, which were entirely different wars from Vietnam, of course. They were wars in which there were large battles in which you might have to confront a charge by North Korean or Chinese tanks coming down through one of the passes and watch your comrades killed on the spot and so on. The Vietnam War was different in that territory made very little difference. It truly was a war for the hearts and minds, to use that old cliche that was so popular in Washington for a while. You could take a ridge line or a village or some kind of terrain feature, capture it absolutely, conquer it, raise your flag, and 24 hours later it wouldn't matter at all because you'd have pulled out. It was not something worth keeping. Nor would the other side hold on to it if you abandon it to them. It was not a war of territory, and it had to be understood in the context of politico-military combat, which is something that we, I think, never really came quite to grips with.
In your book, you write that the universal hallmark of war, the smell of war, is feces mixed with burned and decaying flesh. What is the place of that smell in written coverage? In other words, how much of that should you be letting in, do you think, when you're a journalist covering war?
I think all of it should be ventilated, but of course, physically, you can't smell on television or in the newspaper, fortunately. Also, people who dish up news for breakfast are a little bit leery about including some of the more gruesome details of these things. The pictures that I took of the Buddhist monk who burned himself, for example, fully half of the newspapers in the United States simply refused to publish that on grounds that it was too disgusting for breakfast fare, including the New York Times, by the way. So I'd say that it's a problem, and individual editors and news directors solve it according to their tastes, I guess.
Journalist Malcolm Brown is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Malcolm Brown, author of the new memoir, Muddy Boots and Red Socks. Your mother was a Quaker and a pacifist, and I don't think you shared her religion, and you ended up in the army during the Korean War, and then spent many years covering wars. Is there any element of pacifism in you that you feel you inherited from your mother?
I guess my appreciation of her views came rather late in life. I came more and more to feel that all wars are evil, even the good ones. I grew up in the 30s, and many of us believed that there was only one side. In Spain, for example, the Spanish Civil War was clearly a war between the good guys and the fascists. And we sort of had the feeling that if only we had gone and fought the fascists, we might not have had to fight World War II. Well, a kind of revelation came to me when I was covering the death of Franco in the mid-70s, that somehow the war in Spain had been utterly wasted of life, lives. There were about 2 million people altogether killed there. The bad guys won, hands down. And yet when it was all over, Franco died peacefully in his sleep. There was a transition almost overnight from a fascist dictatorship to a constitutional monarchy, a democracy. And you just have to wonder, even that great war immortalized by Hemingway and Orwell and all of these great writers of the 30s, was it really worth it? And I think that it's possible to look at any war and say, gee, why did those people have to die? So I guess I sort of end my career in the same way that my mother began hers, as with a feeling that war is intrinsically evil and it should be avoided at all cost.
I want to take you back to Vietnam for a minute. You were there during the evacuation of Saigon. Did you have responsibility for other people and their evacuation?
Well, our bureau had...
This was the bureau for...
For the New York Times. We had about 20 Vietnamese staffers and their families. My wife is Vietnamese, and although she's been a U.S. citizen for many years, her family was sort of caught in the maelstrom and was divided up. Some of them came to the United States, and some decided that they should probably remain in Vietnam. This was an agony that virtually every family in South Vietnam went through. They had to decide whether to go to the new world, where there was a completely alien environment, cold weather, reports of racism here and there, or to stay at home and face the possibility of going to a re-education camp or these other horrors that were perpetrated by the Hanoi regime. It was an agonizing decision for everyone. And that was probably the roughest time in my career, trying to sort things out a little bit for our own staff and for so many other Vietnamese with whom I'd been in contact in one way or another, who were eager to get out of the country. So, it was a terrible time.
What did you have to do to help other people out from the Times?
I'd have to say at this point that I think the CIA really came through in a very humane and wonderful way in the final weeks of the war. And if he should hear it, I think the station chief, Tom Polgar, should know that I feel that way about him and his operation. They decided, after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and some pressure from the media and so forth, that there was an obligation on the part of the United States to get out those Vietnamese who were liable to be subject to imprisonment or torture or death by virtue of their associations with Americans, and they came crashing through. And so some of us, my colleague Dave Greenway of the Washington Post and I, we had a little arrangement. We'd ferry as many people out on a given day to the airport. The airport was under guard, and Vietnamese couldn't get into it without having some escorts. And so Dave and I would escort them in, sneak them past the guards, sneak them into the Air America hangar so they could get out, and that sort of thing. It was I think most of the correspondents there were doing the same thing. We were trying to get out our friends, basically.
How many people do you think you helped out?
It's hard to say. The so-called black airlift, black because it was supposedly secret, got out thousands of people. Not all of them connected with the media, of course. There were people in the Vietnamese armed forces and the Vietnamese intelligence, Vietnamese police, and so forth. Many people who had some sort of claim to American loyalties when the roof caved in. There were many thousands of them, and it was every day the airport was just jam packed with people who were on their way into the black airlift.
Was there a part of you that considered staying behind after the fall of Saigon?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to stay behind, but the only American left with me at that point, Fox Butterfield, and I had our orders 2 days before the end from the publisher, Arthur Ox Sulzberger, who insisted that we come out. No ifs, ands, or buts. There had been Sidney Schanberg of the New York Times, who was in covering Phnom Penh, opted to remain in Cambodia after April 17th, after the Khmer Rouge took over there. And I know that this was a source of great concern and worry and inconvenience and high insurance rates and all kinds of problems for the New York Times. And the Times simply didn't want that repeated in Vietnam.
I never think of insurance rates as being something that enters into these decisions, but I guess it does.
Oh, very much so. Insurance rates were prevented me, really, from going to Phnom Penh to bring out our staffers in Cambodia. At the time, we on the outside felt that they probably wanted to get out. And the problem was that the airport, the Po Chi Thang Airport at Phnom Penh, was by that time already under fire, under mortar fire and howitzer fire. And our airplanes, the Times airplane, was insured, of course, for war risk problems. But you needed something called extraordinary war risk to actually land at an airport that was under fire. And that we couldn't get, or rather it was just too expensive and too complicated to get in time. And so I wasn't able to do it.
Have you ever had to use your war insurance policy?
No, I've been actually, I've been, you know, cut up a little bit by flying metal now and then, but never anything very serious. The war risk really covers the airplane rather than the person. And in most cases, the airplanes are two-engine things that are really very expensive. They can run up to, about $1 million. So that that's what you're paying for when you buy insurance, that and the life of the pilot. The correspondent is, of course, expendable.
Nice way to look at it. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Malcolm Brown is science correspondent for The New York Times. His new memoir is called Muddy Boots and Red Socks. This is Fresh Air.